This is the Angry Birds Bird Minute, sponsored by Angry Birds for their 15th anniversary, where we tell you all about a cool bird that may or may not be angry. This week's bird is the emperor penguin. Recognizable as the largest and heaviest penguin in the world, the emperor penguin calls the frigid lands and waters of Antarctica home. During the summer, they spend most of their time at sea, storing up fat for the winter by eating fish, squid, and crabs. The deepest diving bird, they can reach depths of up to 450 meters or 1,500 feet and hold their breaths for half an hour in their search for food. Monogamous for each breeding season, both penguin parents take turns raising the single chick. After the female lays a single egg, she transfers it to the male, where he keeps it warm on the top of his feet under a special layer of skin and feathers. But are they angry? The only bird to breed in Antarctica's winter, emperor penguins have adapted super dense feathers and a thick layer of blubber to protect them from the frigid winds and sub-zero temperatures of the land they call home. On a scale of 1 to angry, we rate the emperor penguin as way cool.
Welcome to Wild Green Streams. I'm Rhett.
I'm Io.
And today on the show, we have Dr. Bruce Means, who over the course of a 60-year career has stacked up a list of accomplishments that are too long to list in a single introduction. For those unfamiliar with your work, Bruce, how would you describe what you do and what are some of the things you've studied in your career?
I consider myself a naturalist. That's a person, you know, obviously who loves nature and all aspects of it. I have formal degrees and I specialize in amphibians and reptiles as the animals I work with, but I'm also an ecologist interested in the different aspects of nature that I can learn about through the lives and behavior of amphibians and reptiles. So I do all kinds of other things, fire ecology, biodiversity studies, and all sorts of things, and have been having a pretty good life doing it.
You've done a lot of work on the tipuis in South America. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what they are and about what you've gone down there to find?
Yes, for sure. Tipuis are a love that I picked up maybe 40 years ago. Most of my work has been done in the southeastern United States, where I've discovered salamanders and named some blind cave crayfishes and done a lot of work on the ecology of the longleaf pine ecosystem. But any decent biologist or ecologist who really wants to think he might know something about how nature operates ought to have some tropical biology under his belt. And over the years, I've spent a lot of time in the tropics. And I especially had in about 1985, 86, I happened to be in Venezuela and see these great big, beautiful mesas the locals, Amerindians, called tepui, T-E-P-U-I. And they rise to over 8,000 feet, and there are about 100 of them. Some of them are small. They're only 5 or 10 acres on size on the top. Others are like 250 square miles. And if you've seen Avatar, those floating islands are sort of taken after the cliff-protected mesas. But also Up, you know, the little movie Up they made?
Mm-hmm.
The
kind of movie?
Well, that's where the balloon house landed, was on top of Mount Roraima, the most famous or best known. If you ever saw the dumb movie called Arachnophobia, they started out some of the first scenics, and where they smoked the trees to get insects and spiders and things to fall out of it was actually in the Tepui country. Hmm. Anyway, Arthur Conan Doyle made the tipuis famous in literature by writing his novel, The Lost World, which was back around the turn of by 1914 when it was published. People had learned about tipuis, but no one had ever ascended one because that was before helicopters. The tipuis are mesas that have vertical cliffs surrounding their summits, and the cliffs are anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000 feet vertical. So unless you do technical climbing, which wasn't developed until the middle of the 20th century, the only way to get on top of one is by helicopter. Well, now that's obviated because technical climbing is in vogue and a lot of people do it, but it's expensive. And anyway, so I fell in love with that part of the world. And I've specialized on a series of unknown tipuis in Guyana. Most of them are known from Venezuela. But Guyana, which is next door to Venezuela, has some as well, which aren't even on maps, for goodness sakes.
Wow.
And just recently, well, you may know about this article in National Geographic that came out last year. It's about my work on those tapuis. It's the kind of thing that naturalists 100 or 150 years ago we used to be able to do. You could go somewhere in the world where no one else, scientists, ever been, and, oh, there's a new frog, or there's a new plant, or there's a new this or that. Well, you can't do that in many places of the world now. The bigger things, like the vertebrate animals, birds, mammals, amphibians, reptiles, fish, are very well known, although there's lots to work yet to do. And yet these tapuis are one of the isolated remote areas where you still can do that. Like, oh my gosh, oh, that's got to be new to science.
That's got to be an amazing feeling.
Oh, it's really wonderful. Actually, it's not as simple as that either, because it turns out what we're learning now with DNA is that there are a lot of undescribed and unrecognized species that are part of what are called cryptic species complexes. Mm-hmm. They all look very similar, and yet they're genetically very distant from each other. And if you do the genetic work to find out what the genes of various populations are, then you can discover, oh, they don't even interbreed because they're so distant genetically. They couldn't, you know, do anything but throw a mule off if they tried, although they look very similar. So that goes on. We're now in a new phase of taxonomy and phylogeny, where people are re-examining suites of animals and plants, even here in the United States, that we've assumed were the same. And now we're discovering that, in fact, there are many, many hidden species among these complexes. There are also ways to determine that animals that look very different may actually be the same species using DNA as well. So anyway, I collaborate with people that have DNA expertise, because at my age, I'm too old to learn the technique. Or I don't want to go into a laboratory and become a laboratory jockey.
Sure. You've also done a lot of work in the southeastern U.S., and I saw that a lot of the early stuff you did was with eastern diamondback rattlesnakes. What was that like?
It was pretty wonderful. I actually, as a graduate student, I got hired as a biologist at a really nice place called the Tall Timbers Research Station in North Florida. And it happened to have maybe 3,000 or 4,000 acres of land that was, you know, had all sorts of animals and plants on the native biology of the region, which included the eastern diamondback. And I'll try to make a long story short. I got frustrated because all the staff and the workers there were killing venomous snakes. And I went to the director and said, hey, what's going on? You know, you can't have a biological research station if you're killing certain parts of the ecology of the food web. And this guy said, oh, well, they're dangerous. And we've been doing that for years. Well, it wasn't too long after that I fortunately got the idea. I just finished my PhD on salamanders. And I was up there at this place where these rattlesnakes occurred. And I went to the literature to find out what had been written about them, what was known. And it turned out the literature was essentially devoid of any real important, good scientific information about what is the largest rattlesnake. And we could consider it the icon snake of North America, for that matter.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Africa's got its lions, India's got its tigers, and we've got the eastern diamondback rattlesnake. This was 1976. And when I decided that, I'm set up to do a study here. So I went to the boss at that time and said, hey, I'm starting a study of this wonderful animal. I'm going to mark and release as many as I can and recapture them. And about that time, one other study had just begun using radio telemetry in snakes. So I found out, you know, who the supplier of the transmitters was. And I was a second person to use radio telemetry studying a population of snakes. So I did that for a good 10 years and generated a huge amount of data. I didn't think to bring you. Do you know about my published work? After 40 years, I put together all my work and all the literature up to 2017 that had ever been published on the Eastern Diamondback in a book entitled Diamonds in the Rough, The Natural History of the Eastern Diamondback Rattlesnake.
A lot of people, like you're saying, that in this location, they were killing the diamondback rattlesnakes. A lot of times snakes don't get the good PR that some of the other animals get to. And especially if we don't have the information about them, people don't know why they should conserve them. So having a book like this that has all the information and also not just, you know, figures of things, but tells the story of why they are important is so essential for these species that to some are uncharismatic. I mean, I personally love them. But it helps their PR, helps get the word out about how important they are for the ecosystem.
What was it like being in the Southeast back then? I mean, I don't know if it would compare to South America, but like, what did it feel like to go outside then?
Well, I put my head in my hands because things have changed. I'm now almost 83. I'll be 83 in March. So I've seen a lot. And believe me, I really mean a lot. I was raised in Alaska. I came into Florida when I graduated from high school when I was 18. By 1961, I wound up here in North Florida, fell in love with the area, and I've kind of stayed here ever since. The panhandle of Florida from about the Suwannee River to the Perdido is one of the top biodiversity hotspots in the United States and Canada. And I'm proud to say that some of my work has been responsible for, you know, bringing that forward and making it known. So it's been a lovely place to be ensconced. But I got to tell you, over that 60 some years, I'm very pessimistic about the plight of nature, original nature on this planet. And here's the thing. Just take the Southeast. The uplands from southeastern Virginia all the way to East Texas used to be the longleaf pine savanna. All the uplands was this fire forest. We're talking 90 some million acres. The bottomlands, the lowlands, were hardwood forests that were protected from fire by being on steep slopes or down in river and creek bottoms. But all the rest of it was this wonderful longleaf pine ecosystem. It has been reduced to less than 1% of its original extent now, and almost none of it is virgin. It's all second growth. There might be now, I think, maybe 0.0001% of it, like 500, 600 acres that are still in old growth condition. They're not virgin by any means because there has been some pilfering. The human population on this planet in my lifetime has, let's see, it's gone from 2 billion to 8. That's four times. It's quadrupled itself in my lifetime. And what I have seen all over the planet and all over the Southeast and all over everywhere else I travel is the unfortunate impact of human beings on nature. And it comes in very obvious ways sometimes, like a clear cut or a building or a, you know, a parking lot or whatever like that, or agriculture, or even silviculture, where they grow trees that are not the tree that was naturally on that spot, or pollution of various sorts, particularly that gets in our water bodies. You know, all of our rivers and lakes and streams are heavily polluted by surface runoff from agriculture to start with, and then from urban and suburban areas as well. You know, all the stuff that we dump on the ground that leaks out of our automobiles, our human waste, they all work their way not only to fresh water, but eventually to the sea. And anyway, so that's why I put my head in my hands. It's it's feeding back on us. Look at global warming. I mean, if nobody believes in global warming anymore, they're pretty darn stupid.
I'm also originally from South Florida, but I went to school at UF also, and I've been up to Tall Timbers and I've seen the area, and I love the longleaf pine ecosystem and the fire ecosystem. And I, you know, especially in South Florida, there's the Everglades, which everyone knows is, you know, such an ecological wonder. But then realizing even in just a little further north, in the north part of the state, it's just way more diversity than you could have thought. Because, you know, just having the Everglades on your doorstep, you think, well, this is clearly the hotspot of the ecological system in Florida. But no, it's way more than I ever thought. And learning about it and getting to go into some of those areas was really cool to be able to see what a unique environment it is, and all the animals that have adapted to those ecosystems is really neat.
Yeah, right. I I'm kind of a hopeful person by nature, and something that what you were saying, the population metric of it going from 2 billion to 8 billion in one lifetime, that's pretty incredible. But what that brings to mind a little bit for me is we have a nonprofit that we run in addition to this podcast and meme page and everything. And one of our partners down in southern Peru, they use a leaf cutter ant as their symbol, as their mascot. And the reasoning behind that is that leaf cutter ants are an agricultural species. They use the leaves that they cut to grow fungi for anyone listening. And they have a similar biomass to the humans in the Amazon rainforest as well. But they've existed for over 60 million years there and haven't led to, at least at this stage, a decline in biodiversity. So they chose that as their symbol because the idea is that if one agricultural species can do it and be at that level, then maybe we can as well.
Well, there's no doubt we can, because we know all this stuff. You know, we use science to generate answers to all of our questions about things, and that science has pointed to our understanding of what we're doing to the planet. But the problem for us is, will we? Because politics generates an awful lot of what we do, and people, it's hard to get, well, you know, just look at the political situation around the planet. I mean, I'm glad you're hopeful. That comes with youth, and I think you've got a lot more youth than I do.
Yeah. Well, when I think about those things, when I look at them in the context of what we have to lose, like your work has illuminated a lot of, and the problems, what I think of is, okay, those are the stakes. And I had to think a lot to make this something I can think about productively. But what I just decided is, okay, well, those are the stakes. And if I were going to be alive in any given time, which one would I rather try to work in, you know, which one would be more tangible to try to make stuff better. And I think this one's one of those opportunity periods where we have these big problems, but maybe we can actually do something about them.
Well, look, the bottom line is this. I have two sons. They're both naturalists as well. One of them, the younger one, got pretty despondent over what he's seen and me carping about, you know, the decline of biodiversity all over the planet. And I sat him down and said, look, all right, here's how you have to look at it. The life on Earth is not going to disappear. It might be terrifically impacted by, you know, tremendous species loss, like some of the other big extinction events that have happened on this planet, not due to humans. And life will come back. But the sad thing about it is that we're probably going to lose a lot of the stuff that we love in nature because of what we're doing to nature, and not actively able to deal with it as quickly as we ought to. So the Earth will recover. Humans may not. Think of it this way. We may be one of thousands of experiments on different globes around the universe. So where do we fit on that bell curve? Are we way over here in the, oh, those on that side are never going to make it.
Right.
Are we in the middle where are they, you know, and over here, oh, these always make it. I have a feeling.
Hard to tell while we're in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the bottom line is, enjoy your life while you have it. Do the best you can to try to conserve the parts of nature that you can. And here's one of the reasons why that's important. If you want to learn like we do, because we're a cognitive species, right? If you want to learn about the environment, about yourself, about nature, about how things operate, you need to look at systems that are operating as naturally as they have come to operate over their evolutionary history. So an unspoiled natural environment, of which there are fewer and fewer left on the planet anymore, is the laboratory in which, and the best laboratory, in which we can go to learn how the ecological functioning of systems, biological systems, works. You're not going to go out into a rice field and learn a whole lot more than you would if you went into a tropical rainforest and tried to learn what the interaction between species really is all about and how biodiversity can serve us best,
right?
Because of the low diversity in the rice field. So the point is that anything we can do to conserve these wonderful natural laboratories that we've inherited over through time is a worthy cause, but there's so few of them left any longer.
That's totally a reasonable take, I think. What's it like to go on one of these expeditions to the Tepuis? I watched a couple of your films with National Geographic about it, but like, what's the experience of that like?
It's absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's what I live for and why I'm thrilled that I've had. There was a documentary that accompanied this National Geographic article. It's streaming now on Disney Plus. It's called The Last Tepui. I can't tell you how wonderful it is to be in nature, knowing that you're in unspoiled nature and being able to see how nature is interacting, different plants and animals with each other on an undisturbed basis. And finding new species is great fun. It's only the beginning, though. You know, you can't learn about a forest, much about the activities of a forest, if you don't know the trees that comprise the forest. So you got to learn about what the trees are. You know, just take two pine trees. If you don't know the difference between slash pine and longleaf pine, and Iowa, if you don't know that slash pine is extremely, particularly when it's young, vulnerable to fire, and longleaf is not, and you want to deal with prescribed burning, you don't want to prescribe burn young slash pine because you'll destroy it. So you need to know, you have to learn about the building blocks of nature before you can understand the bigger pictures. That's a large share of the message in this book, Camp in the Tropics. Sorry, I'm plugging it.
Oh, no, that's what this is for.
Your question. And it's all about the thrills and excitements and what it's like to be in the field, often by myself alone or with a party or two. And daily, you know, hear the birds and the tinkling of the creeks and the rustling of the leaves and get up and see something, or go out at night, which I really like most to do, go out at night with a headlight where everything is more or less under my control. You know, you're not going to be attacked by anything at night when nothing else can see and you got this big bright light on it. And you go slowly and you see, oh, there's a beautiful red frog sitting on that leaf. And over here is a scorpion over here. And I saw a couple of spiders interacting, you know, and I thought, oh, well, that was the male because he's got the long pedipalps. And they were doing this. And I came back later and she had been inseminated by the male, but she also rolled him up in a cocoon and she was eating him. You know, stuff like that. Nature is wonderful. If you're a naturalist, meaning you love nature, then to be in it is heaven. It's peaceful, beautiful, soulful.
Throughout your career, you've done all sorts of discoveries and, you know, introduce information, but across also all different mediums and formats. So like many scientific papers, books, documentaries, you know, just to name a few. And is there any that you think are better means of communicating the information than others, or just some that you liked the process better than others where you're like, oh, I'm going to do this because I know this will have a good product, but it's not as fun as, you know, doing this other thing. Is there any difference in that, like, data collection, as it were?
Yeah, there's a big difference. A lot of scientists just do their science and don't reach out to the public. I believe I owe society back for the privilege I've had of being able to do my research and my science. And if you learn about something, you can't appreciate something if you don't learn about it or know about it. So once you know about some things like the animals and the plants I work with, then you appreciate them. And if you realize that if no one else appreciates them, they're going to disappear, then you feel like, oh, what can I do to help that not happen? So writing for public consumption and doing podcasts and doing occasional television spots or whatever is a way I've chosen to get my message out to people about how wonderful nature is, and do your best to appreciate it like I do and help me do whatever we can to conserve it, what's left of it. The best medium for that, as you, I think you asked also at first, whether it's books or scientific papers or not, that's the, you know, the working product of doing your science. But then it's writing a book or writing a popular article or doing a production like we're doing now is how you reach out to more people to try to bring them into appreciation like you have.
Growing up in Alaska, where did that original inspiration come from for you?
Well, my family sort of homesteaded. We purchased some land that had just been homesteaded 12 and a half miles out of Anchorage up in the mountains of the Chugach Range. And I spent my high school years with my dad helping him build a beautiful log home. out of the trees that were on this property we owned. And, you know, I came to appreciate the Alaskan wilderness. Our property was more or less in the wilderness. And even before that, when I was a kid, before we went to Alaska, up until I was 9 years old, I was out in the Santa Monica Mountains of Southern California, where I learned to wander around in the chaparral woodlands there and learn to love all the critters and the plants there. I don't know whether it's an innate thing in me or not to love nature, to love animals and plants. But then when I came to Florida and this part of Florida where I've spent 60 years of my life, is so fabulous, full of animals and plants that I like and have studied. I'm very lucky.
It's incredible to me that there are mountains above the water still that aren't fully explored, that there are places
not
like
even
Tucuris.
On maps.
Right. Yeah, like that's amazing. When I found that out, it made the world feel a little bit, or actually like so much bigger to me than it did before, because I had just been kind of living with the assumption that there was, you know, there weren't any, maybe there was some frozen rock somewhere at like the top of the Himalayas that people had never climbed to because it's hard or something. But the idea that there's a place that's just still covered in plants and animals and hadn't been, you know, even geographically fully explored is kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, that's very exciting, obviously, the Tepuys, because of that. The reason for them not being very well explored is, of course, they're surrounded by cliffs, those vertical cliffs, and it's very expensive and also technically very difficult to mount a climbing expedition. Not many of those have ever happened. This one I just did was a video production, really, but I got a lot of science done while I was doing it. Helicopters are now available to take you to the summits, but the interesting thing is that's not where the biodiversity is. As you go higher in altitude, anywhere on the planet, you probably know this, you feel it in your bones, the species richness is going to decline because you're getting into more and more climate severe environments. The climate alone, you know, getting colder and sometimes wetter. In the tropics, it often gets wetter. And also in the tropics, this is an interesting phenomenon. The higher you get in the tropics, when the sun does come out, it's very dangerous because you don't have the atmosphere on. The sun is coming pretty much straight down on you, and you're getting infrared and ultraviolet radiation much more intensely than you get in northern and southern, far southern latitudes. Plants and animals have to be specially adapted to avoid the insolation, sol meaning sun. Yeah, the Tepuys, first off, they're remote. There are other places where high altitudes are remote. New Guinea is one of the biggest islands on the planet, and New Guinea's just chock full of stuff that needs to be worked. Many of the islands in the Malay Archipelago, besides New Guinea, have high altitude areas that have not been, and media, but it's the middle areas where they're heavily forested, so you can't get to them by helicopter.
Right.
You can only get to them by surface, you know, expeditions, and those are very fraught with difficulties because of streams and rivers, and running out of food is what usually, you know, stops a foot expedition.
That's kind of where you were trying to get to in the last Tepuy film, right? Like was like a middle zone on that one.
Exactly. And boy, did I ever reap rewards doing that in that middle zone. Now, it's not to say there aren't things on the summits that still we're learning about, because some of these summits are very large and there are likely species still on the summits that haven't been determined. But the slopes, from 4,000 feet to about 7,000 feet, those talus slopes where the rock, where the cliff walls are falling down and making a 45 degree angle talus slope, that's called a cloud forest because it's high enough to be wet all the time, rainy, misty, and windy, and the trees are kind of all gnarled. They're all full of moss and other epiphytes. Epiphytes are plants that grow on top of plants like orchids and bromeliads and mosses and the like. That produces a huge ecosystem of places for animals to live and hide and eat from the ground level all the way to the canopy. Whereas, you know, if you go down a rainforest where sometimes all you have is the ground level and a high canopy and not much in the middle zone, that's connected. I mean, you can have a middle layer of forest, but it's not all connected like it is in a cloud forest. And so the species richness really jumps up there. And on this trip, I found at least three species of frogs, at least two lizards new to science, and for sure one really cool little snake. The snake is so different from all other snakes, we just published this, that it's a new genus.
Wow, that's incredible.
That river valley we were in that goes up to the summit tops, mm-hmm. that's the head of a river called the Piqua, P-A-I-K-W-A, the Piqua River. Mm-hmm. So I named it Piqua ophis. That means Piqua ophis, and we named it after a guy named Kruk. Piqua mm-hmm. ophis krukai. Well, Piqua ophis means snake of Piqua River. And it's the only specimen ever found of this thing. It's a juvenile, but genetically it was real easy to, get the genes to tell sure. us what it was. And then we did osteological work, which it was old enough juvenile that the bones were all well put together, and we could compare the bones of this thing to all the other animals that it could be related to by the DNA test we did. And we discovered it was, so different, it deserved its own genus rank.
That's so amazing. Incredible. And you sort of alluded to this a little bit earlier, but finding the species in situ is a species new to science is sort of just the first step. And so for those who may not have the joy of finding a species new to science, what is after that first initial step where you're like, I think this is a new species to science? What are the subsequent steps to sort of verify that? And also, I can imagine keeping samples in the middle of a cloud forest is probably its own logistical challenges. So what is the rest of that, the after steps, like after the initial excitement of, oh, I think this is a new species?
Well, when you are doing your scientific field work like that, and you find a specimen that's scientifically noteworthy, you photograph it a lot, belly, head, back, all that. And then, unfortunately, you have to make a museum specimen out of it, because it has to be studied, you have to dissect it later, which is going to kill it, obviously, to look at its internal organs, and you have to do other things. So, unfortunately, you have to sacrifice a few of them. This was only one that I had to kill, because that's the only one we found. I'd sure like to see an adult of this thing, and one day someone no doubt will find one. But here's the bottom line I think you were leading toward. Now that I've found a new species and named it, now what? What does all that mean? Well, now we know we got this neat little creature out there. It turns out we found it in the leaf litter on the ground of this high-altitude camp we were in the cloud forest. And when we did a dissection, we found some scales of a little lizard in its stomach. And the lizard is probably new to science too, but there wasn't enough. There wasn't enough information in the scales we found to be able to name it. But we know now that there's a lizard there that this thing had fed upon. All right, what does this little snake do? When it grows up and becomes a bigger snake, how big does it get? What does it feed on? Or, what animals eat it? So you're beginning to then ask, what role does this little snake play in the food web there? You're asking a higher order question, not just, oh, it's a new species. What does it do? How important is it in the cycling of all the nutrients in the whole ecosystem? And so on and so forth. So now we're off to doing higher order studies, because we can ask more sophisticated questions about how important this animal might be in the workings of nature in which it lives.
Maybe one day someone will be able to publish a full compendium about that snake, the way that you have published about the Eastern Diamondback. And right. That'll be, just coming full circle and continuing the cycle of research and discovery.
And you never know what you're going to discover. You discover, for all I know, this snake drills a hole in the leaf litter with its tail. Actually, in Australia one time, I was there doing a documentary in Australia, and after all that was gone, I stayed a month or two. I was driving up a paved road way off in Western Australia, and I came to this legless lizard that was out in the road. So I get out with my camera, and I go to photograph it, And the darn lizard started bouncing head, tail, head, tail. To get away from me, it was springing on its head and its tail to get away from me. Now, if that's not enough, believe it or not, on that same road cruising trip, I come to a little snake about this big, and those almost all the snakes in Australia are venomous. And this was a little venomous snake. It was a very pretty thing, and I'm trying to take a photograph of it, and I had my little snake stick, and I'm goosing it to, and all of a sudden, it did the same thing. It started bouncing head to tail down the road. And I've been trying to get BBC or somebody to take me back to Australia so we can film that, because it's an outrageously strange and interesting behavior, and two animals do it. Now, I've also found a piece of literature, a piece of scientific literature in Australia, where somebody has reported that same behavior. I think it's either the snake or the lizard. So I'm not, you know, hallucinating. I actually saw this kind of behavior. But wonderful things like that you're going to find.
Why do you think that two animals as, you know, separate as a snake and a lizard have a similar behavior, have that same weird mode of moving there?
A wonderful question. Yeah, there's a PhD for you right there.
There you go. If anyone listening needs a PhD proposal and they don't have one yet, we've got some perfect ideas for you here.
Yeah, just about everywhere you look, there's something really wonderful.
There's something crazy.
There's no dearth of wonderful science to be done on this planet yet. We haven't, we've just scratched the surface, let's put it that way.
The more I learn about research that other people are doing, because as much as I wish I could do research in every field of science there is, I am but one person and it's not possible. So I love hearing about what other people are researching. And the more, especially with the very nuanced topics about this, you know, specific chemistries in soils or in seawater or whatever, I'm so excited about not only what we have discovered, but what there is still left to discover. Because sometimes it can feel like we talked about earlier, like, oh, you know, I didn't get to explore, you know, things. I didn't get to discover things. But there's still so much out there that we don't know. And it's so exciting, the prospect of being able to find out and just learn more. Like, there's just so much. I just, instead of, some people might think that it might be scary that we don't know, but I'm just excited about all the things that we, that are out there to discover. It's just so great.
So that leads into my question that I have for you, which is, if you were just starting out now, looking around at the wildlife and the wild places that either that you got to go to or that you haven't been to yet, what would you be most excited to go look at and where would you be exploring?
I couldn't have put in your mouth a question I would rather have heard. Because I'm delighted to tell you that if I had to start all over knowing what I do now, I would get into the microcosmos. The world is full of bacteria and, well, it's full of all kinds of organisms that are microscopic level that are so important and so impactful on this planet. We don't know a whole lot about it yet. I mean, but, you know, as deep as you can drill in the into the crust of this earth, they found microorganisms down there. Now, let me tell you, in tepuis, tepuis are made of sandstone. They're not limestone. They're a whole bunch of layers of sandstone have been laid down, and they're being eroded away, leaving these mesas, you know, or they're erosional remnants where rivers have washed away the intervening land. But because they were laid down as in sedimentary layers, we've learned in the last 20 years, some other naturalists, a really good one in Venezuela, has discovered caves in these tepuis. And these caves are unbelievable. They don't have easy access mouths because of all the rubble that's fallen down. They found about four or five of them. But when you get into them, they open up. They're huge. They're like, you know, an airplane hangar inside. But there's all this wonderful stuff going on. And what's in there are, you know what stalactites and stalagmites are, right?
Yeah.
They are in limestone. Water dissolves calcium carbonate as it's percolating through the cracks and fissures. And when the water evaporates as it's dripping into a cave, the calcium carbonate is left behind because the water evaporates and it doesn't take the calcium carbonate. So it grows that. Those are called speleothems. Well, if you get into these sandstone caves, which are made of silicon, you know, sand. They're just glass. There's no silicon dioxide. There's nothing much to dissolve there. But these caves are full of all these rock formations, and some of them are they're not like, you know, stalactite and stalagmite. They're called biospeleothems, and they're what they are is they're leftover. They're the metabolic product leftovers of autotrophs. All right. Auto means self-operating, trophic. Autotrophs are like plants. Plants are autotrophs. We're not. We have to eat plants or animals that eat plants. But plants make their own nutrients and energy and the like from photosynthesis. There's a whole world of other organisms out there that antedate, go back before the plants, those autotrophs. They are bacteria and archaea, and which is a blue-green algae. There's a couple other words from there. They're microscopic organisms, one-cell organisms, that generate their energy from iron, sulfur, magnesium, a whole bunch of other compounds, by reducing those compounds and using that energy to metabolize. So this is a, you know, I'm kind of looking at your faces. What's he talking about? Well, that is a part of our planet we know very little about, because there are some autotrophic situations where you've ever seen this kind of rusty looking scum on water in standing water situations. It's a bacteria, bacterium that does the same thing. That rusty color, which usually makes you think of a polluted site, but that rusty color is iron that is left behind from this bacterium using iron to make its energy, generate its energy and get its tissues. But in these caves are these wonderful things. There, have you ever heard the word stromatolite?
Oh yeah. Yeah, like in Australia.
Well, stromatolites are the same thing. And they go back before any photosynthetic activity. Stromatolites are bacteria that lay down as a metabolic end product mineral substances that coat the surface that they are living on, and it gets bigger over time. So famous ones are in Australia, but they have been around since before almost some of the earliest forms of life. So in other words, you ask me what I would really like to get into, it would be studying those other autotrophs than the plants that do photosynthesis, because they're so exotic and so interesting.
That's a great thing to pick. And now I'm just like, oh, maybe I should change my career and study those now, because every day I think, oh, I should study something else. So yeah, a great selection.
It's almost infinite. Before we finish up today, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Well, I've, with lack of humility, I've been plugging a lot of things, but I was trying to plug my Base Camp in the Tropics, because it's just now out. This book's available on Amazon.com. And if you've enjoyed this talk, you get some idea there.
Oh, yeah. There's lots of great photos in there. That's amazing.
I hope that this book would more abundantly bring you into the conversation we've just had.
Well, you know, Io and I know Io has this book because we both took the same classes in undergrad, but Io and I have another one of your books, Priceless Florida, on our bookshelves, so maybe we'll start a collection.
There we go. Oh,
great. All right. Sounds good. I'd be honored.
Work up with a whole shelf's worth is the goal.
Thanks for listening. If you want to support this podcast and the Wild Green Media ecosystem, you can go to patreon.com/wildgreenmemes. That's memes with an M. Until next time, I'm Rhett.
I'm Io.
And I am Bruce Means. You can call me Doctor if you like.
And happy Year of the Raccoon.